This morning, America's first news starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
A devastating and deadly earthquake in Indonesia. Good morning. I'm Mike Gavin, in for Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Kashenka. It's Monday, August 6th, 2018, and here's what we have for you this hour.
Dozens are confirmed and more feared dead after a 6.9 magnitude earthquake struck an Indonesian resort island, collapsing or badly damaging thousands of buildings.
Meanwhile, it was a deadly weekend in Chicago, where at least 40 were shot and 4 killed.
President Trump is defending his son's meeting with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 election campaign.
And why America's long love affair with beer is on the rocks.
There was a striking figure that was actually released by the Beer Institute, which is the trade body for big brewers in the U.S. And they said for the first time on record, the number of occasions on which people actually reach for a beer versus a wine, a glass of wine or a cocktail, had slipped to below 50%.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sabra Chowdhury with more on why more of us are ditching beer for bourbon and rosé all day. That story in about 20 minutes. Rescue workers found chaos and destruction across the Indonesian resort island of Lombok this morning after a magnitude 6.9 earthquake killed dozens and prompted an exodus of tourists rattled by the second powerful tremor in a week. More from this morning's Dave Duncan.
At least 91 people were killed in the quake, but officials say that number is expected to rise as information comes in from areas where thousands of buildings collapsed or were badly damaged, especially in the quake's epicenter in the north. Power and communications were cut in some areas of Lombok, and the military said it was sending in a vessel with medical aid, supplies, and logistical support for the island. Lombok was hit a week earlier by a 6.4 magnitude quake that killed 17, injured hundreds, and briefly stranded several hundred trekkers on the slopes of a volcano. Mike?
Thanks, Dave. The Indonesian Red Cross tweeted that it helped a woman give birth after the quake at a health post in the north. One of the names she gave the baby boy was Gempa, which means earthquake. A violent and deadly weekend in Chicago where at least 40 people were shot during the 7 hours from midnight Saturday to early Sunday morning with 4 fatalities. A stark violent streak in a city where authorities say gun violence has been decreasing this year. Local media reported that the brunt of the violence happened in the city's west side where 25 people were shot in separate attacks. Chicago Police Patrol Chief Fred Waller.
Incidents of either random or targeted shooting on our streets is totally unacceptable.
Police said gunmen targeted a block party, a gathering after a funeral, and other gatherings on a night where thousands of people gathered for a downtown concert, and that most of the shootings were connected to gang violence. At one point, the violence was so severe that a hospital spokesman told the Chicago Tribune the emergency department at Mount Sinai stopped accepting cases just because of the sheer amount of shootings. The Tribune reported earlier this month that shootings in the city this year had actually declined, with 533 fewer shootings as of August 1st than the same time last year. Chicago has recorded more than 300 murders in 2018, more than any other U.S. city, but Waller stressed that the total is down 25% from a year ago. President Trump acknowledged Sunday that a meeting his son held with a Russian government lawyer in June of 2016 was an attempt to get information on Democrat Hillary Clinton, but defended the encounter as totally legal. Mr. Trump and his eldest son, Donald Jr., have repeatedly denied that the president had advanced knowledge of the Trump Tower meeting with a Russian lawyer with links to the Kremlin. The meeting has come under scrutiny of special counsel Robert Mueller, but the meeting has become a prominent focus in Mr. Mueller's investigation into whether Trump associates can collude with Russia in 2016, and whether the president and his aides sought to obstruct justice by initially asserting that the meeting focused only on adoptions. Mr. Trump has denied collusion or obstruction, and Moscow has denied election interference. Jay Sekulow, one of the president's attorneys, said Sunday on ABC that he has no knowledge of Donald Jr. being a target of any investigation.
I don't represent Don Jr., but I will tell you I have no knowledge at all of Don Jr. being told that he's a target of any investigation, and I have no knowledge of him being interviewed by the special counsel.
The initial statement about the meeting came of July of 2017 from Donald Trump Jr. and was crafted with the help of his father. That statement claimed the participants primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children. The younger Mr. Trump later released emails showing that he accepted the offer for the meeting after he was promised information about Mrs. Clinton that he had been told was gathered as part of a Russian effort to boost his father's candidacy. Mr. Sekulow last year denied the president participated in the writing of the initial statement from his son's meeting. On Sunday, he told ABC he had bad information at that time and made a mistake. It's 11 minutes now after the hour. On This Morning, America's First News. Gordon Deal still on vacation. I'm Mike Gavin. Thanks for coming by on this Monday when we take you from shooting in the streets to shooting in schools. Eye-opening story from the Wall Street Journal, which writes that school administrators now consider the likelihood of a shooting real enough that some districts are buying active shooter insurance, which could include things like death benefits for victims and trauma counseling for students. For more, we turn to Tawnell Hobbs, education reporter for the Journal based in Chicago. She joins us now with more on this story. Tawnell, take us through this so-called active assailant insurance and what it does.
Basically, it would cover calls that are not typically covered in general liability policies, you know, such as funeral costs or paying out death benefits, and even some of the crisis management programs, it covers that. And, you know, some school administrators tell me it's really a peace of mind for them to have something like this.
So how does this differ from a school's general liability insurance?
Well, basically, general liability typically is going to cover matters that pertain to negligence. You know, negligence that results in personal and physical injury, death, or property damage. But it's there's going to have to be some kind of negligence, not typically someone, you know, just walking in a school and shooting. With these school shooter insurance policies, they basically kick in upon there being a school shooting, or they also call it active assailant, because you could actually have someone that would come in there with a knife or something like that, and that's when those type of policies kick in. So you don't have to prove negligence for those to kick in. It's just the attack itself.
How many of these policies have been sold?
You know, there's really no official tally. I know there's a large provider of the insurance, and they have sold since 2016 over 300 policies. There's some estimates that triple that number, which, you know, there's 90-something thousand schools in the country. So that's, you know, not hard to believe. But, you know, even ever since our story ran, there's, you know, I've received a lot of calls from schools just kind of wanting contact numbers of some of these insurance brokers.
Right. How much does it cost, and how do they set the premiums for this?
Well, and that can vary widely. Basically, the premiums, when they set, they're looking at student population, student and employee population. They're looking at the location, how dangerous, how many gun incidents have they had. They even sometimes will look at litigation. It's like, is this an area that's known, you know, to, you know, where lawsuits are filed a lot? They look at the security at the school. I mean, do they have armed guards? You know, do they have any kind of, you know, programs that could help students, and especially students who might be distraught or need counseling? So they factor all of that in to come up with these premiums, and these premiums can really range. I mean, you can have in some of these small school systems, the premiums could be about $1,800 for $1 million in coverage, and then up to the larger school systems, you could be looking at $175,000 annual premium for $20 million in coverage.
Is there any particular type of school that seems more likely to be buying into this type of insurance at this point?
No, not really. I mean, I have found large school systems, and I have found smaller school systems. What I did notice that was interesting, schools are not very comfortable talking about this. I mean, I was turned away from several schools that just said they just didn't want to draw attention to it, because the idea of having to use this kind of coverage is just so undesirable that they just don't want to talk about it. But they're getting it, but a lot of them really don't want to talk about it. But it's small, it's large district. I mean, they're all sizes.
And if they are getting this, as you said, it's a sensitive topic, they may not be necessarily sharing this information with parents and in the community.
Yeah, it's and sometimes they don't, but then also, it just depends on the amount of coverage. You have some of these larger school systems where, you know, if you if there is a transaction over a certain amount, it's going to have to get school board approval. So it might just appear on an agenda. Now, they might not publicize it, and you might not know what they're talking about, but for some of the larger districts, they might.
All right, thanks very much, Tawnell. Wall Street Journal education reporter Tawnell Hobbs joining us this morning from Chicago. 20 minutes after the hour now, Jennifer Koschenka is here with more of America's First News.
Mike, President Trump appears to have changed his story about a 2016 meeting at Trump Tower that is pivotal to the special counsel's investigation, tweeting that his son met with a Kremlin-connected lawyer to collect information about his political opponent. Trump tweeted yesterday that the meeting was totally legal and done all the time in politics and that he didn't know about it. 13 months ago, a statement dictated by the president but released under the name Donald Trump Jr. said the meeting was primarily about a Russian adoption program. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. intends to fully enforce sanctions due to be imposed against Iran earlier this week on orders from President Trump. Washington's so-called snapback sanctions are due to be reinstated against Tehran at 12:01 a.m. on Tuesday. Indonesian officials say efforts to find victims in the rubble of a mosque collapsed by yesterday's earthquake in North Lombok has been hampered by the lack of heavy equipment. Authorities say the current death toll over 90 will definitely increase. The devastation has isolated hard-hit areas from rescuers and made distribution of resources difficult. Five people have died after their small plane crashed into a shopping center parking lot in Santa Ana, California. The twin-engine Cessna plane was bound for John Wayne Airport when it crashed a mile away yesterday. Orange County Fire Captain Tony Bomarito.
The fact that there was no injuries on the ground is a miracle in itself.
The pilot had declared an emergency before the incident, and national transportation authorities are now investigating the cause of the crash.
You said you had one 13-year-old daughter. You didn't say anything about two boys coming to live here. I don't do windows, and I don't do boys.
Charlotte Ray, who played a wise and patient house mother to a brood of teenage girls in the long-running sitcom The Facts of Life during a career that encompassed many other TV roles, as well as stage and film appearances, has died. The 92-year-old died at her Los Angeles home yesterday. A cause of death was not immediately released, but Ray was diagnosed last year with bone cancer. She originated the character of Mrs. Garrett in 1978 during the first season of NBC's comedy Different Strokes.
That is sad. If you were of my age demographic, you watched everybody watch Different Strokes and everybody watched Facts of Life. So we were well acquainted with Mrs. Garrett.
Yeah.
That is sad. Thanks very much, Jim. Coming up on 23 minutes after the hour. Now on This Morning, America's First News. So an American walks into a bar. The bartender says, what'll it be? For years, more likely than not, the answer would have been, make it a beer. Not anymore. Last year, for the first time, Americans reaching for a drink more often chose a glass of wine or a cocktail. This despite a boom in craft breweries, which have not been able to offset steep declines in drinkers reaching for big-name beers like Bud, Miller, and Coors. More on this trend from Sabra Chowdhury, Wall Street Journal reporter based in London. Sabra, start by taking us through some of the numbers here.
So there was a striking figure that was actually released by the Beer Institute, which is the trade body for big brewers in the U.S. And they said for the first time on record, the number of occasions on which people actually reach for a beer versus a wine, a glass of wine or a cocktail, had slipped to below 50%. And this is striking because I think beer volumes have been coming down for a number of years, but going below the 50% threshold felt like a little bit of a turning point. And the big brewers themselves for the last couple of years, I think in particular, have really warned that if this trend continues, there's a possibility that beer may not continue to be America's biggest alcoholic beverage in years to come.
And you write that young people in particular are driving this trend. How long have we been seeing this shift?
I'd say it's been going on for a number of years gradually. It's not a sudden drop. And craft beer for a long time was growing very strongly. And so that definitely helped prop up overall sales of beer. Lately, even craft beer volumes have started to slow. And craft beer is it's a sizable chunk, but it's not kind of big enough to make up for the volume declines at the big brewers. And so I think some people were surprised by the story because they thought, well, craft beer is growing really strongly. How could it be that beer is not actually doing well? And I think it's important to note that craft beer is still, you know, a minority of the beer industry, and that the volume declines are really in the old big beer brands like Budweiser, Miller Lite, Coors Light, Bud Light. Those are the brands that have really suffered the big declines.
Yeah, I mean, if you didn't look at the numbers, you'd think that the beer business in this country was booming. I mean, hardly a day goes by when you don't hear about another craft brewery or beer garden opening up. But as you said, this masks the overall decline of beer consumption, particularly the big brands, as you said, like Bud and Coors.
Yeah, and also, just because there are more craft brewers doesn't mean that people's consumption of beer is going up. So we've seen data showing that per capita consumption of beer in the U.S. has actually been going down. So I think the market is becoming more fragmented. It doesn't necessarily mean that people are drinking more beer just because there are more craft brewers on the scene.
And you say that mass market beers are also caught up in the overall trend of younger people wanting to consume food and drink that's local, more natural, or perceived as healthier.
Right, exactly. And I think that's why it's probably good to keep in context the fact that the declines at craft brewers, the volume declines that we're seeing at the smaller brewers, are not as big as the ones we're seeing at the big brewers.
All right, thanks, Sabra. Wall Street Journal reporter Sabra Chowdhury joining us from London. Coming up on 30 minutes after the hour now, on This Morning, America's First News.
There's nothing small about your business. Your passion, your hours, your reputation, it's all huge. Your partnerships, even bigger. With Dell Small Business Technology Advisors, you'll get the tech, advice, and one-on-one partnership to help your business grow. Because with reliable Dell PCs with Intel Core processors, you can focus on what matters most, getting business done. Call 877-BUY-DELL to speak with an advisor today. That's 877-BUY-DELL.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email, thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
34 minutes after the hour, Gordon Deal is off. I'm Mike Gavin, sitting in on this Monday, the 6th day of August. Here's some of the headlines we're following for you this morning. The second big quake in a week in Indonesia kills dozens. Four were killed and 40 shot as gun violence escalated over the weekend in Chicago. President Trump defends his son and changes his story about the meeting with a Russian lawyer in a hotel room during the campaign. Sad news for 80s TV fans as Charlotte Ray, who played Mrs. Garrett on The Facts of Life, has passed away. She was 92. And speaking of folks living long lives, a look at the Milwaukee woman who celebrated her 100th birthday and her secret ingredient to living a long, healthy life. I'll give you a hint. It involves hops and barley. That story in about 20 minutes. While we continue to bring you stories about gang violence in major cities like Chicago, politicians and advocates in these big cities are scrutinizing police departments for the way they label and track suspected gang members, saying the methods lack oversight and unfairly expose minorities to the criminal justice system. Police departments in L.A., New York, and Chicago use databases that include thousands of people, mostly minorities, some of whom haven't been arrested for a crime. More on that controversy from Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Cano-Youngs. Zolan, take us through what you found here.
Basically, let's take a step back. These gang databases are used by police departments throughout the country. The ones that we focused on are some of the bigger ones in Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago. And this goes back to the classic argument, really, when you come to policing. You know, I think when you have police officials, the priority is public safety, you know, something that a lot of people would think is a good thing. And using technology and the latest tools to ensure public safety. And on the other side, you have a lot of legal officials and advocates that would say privacy is also a priority, and that needs to be prioritized when ensuring public safety. And at the center of that, we have these gang databases. So in an effort to basically keep track of gangs, and when I say gangs, I mean people that are in them, allegedly, where they frequent, different gang territories, who's a rival of who, the police departments throughout the country are using these gang databases, the criteria of which for the criteria they use to enter people into said databases has come under scrutiny for being too ambiguous, being a bit too loose. And we've seen some examples of some of that ambiguity across the country.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Cano-Youngs. Zolan, what's an example of that?
Let's look at California. Okay, so in 2016, an audit is conducted by the state attorney general in California. It found that police officials were entering people into the database on without adequate evidence that they were in a gang. A good example could be the more than 40 infants that were entered into a gang, into the gang database. I would think many would say that's a little odd. 28 of those infants were entered for, quote, admitting to being gang members, which I think people would agree is a little bit odd. I mean, look, some of this could come down to just ensuring that you have proper maintenance of these databases. However, doing something like that, even if it's just human error, can have real impacts on people's lives afterwards. You know, in New York, police detectives basically use that after the killing, I'm sure that your listeners know, of Junior Sandro Guzman in the Bronx, 15-year-old, case of mistaken identity, stabbed to death allegedly by the Trinitarios. The NYPD uses the database in a way that a lot of the Bronx residents I talked to really loved. You know, they that incident happens, and then they go into their gang database and basically look up, okay, who's the rival of the Trinitarios? Now let's deploy officers over to that area so we can prevent any type of retaliatory act. So that's an example where I think you kind of see that police are using this for public safety. But the problem is that there's also a lot of people in New York, in Chicago, in L.A. that say that once they're in the gang database, it's a little bit hard to get out. There's examples of some people saying that, you know, they were entered into a gang database without their knowledge, only to find out later they were in the gang database when they committed a low-level crime and they were labeled a gang member. Or in the case of Mr. Pedrote Salinas, Luis Pedrote Salinas in Chicago, he alleges in a lawsuit he was wrongly entered into Chicago's database in 2011 as a member of the Latin Kings, and it led to detainment proceedings. So we can see, deportation proceedings. So we can see that this will have, this tool that is a policing tool will have a lasting impact on a lot of the people that allegedly are entered in.
It's easy to see why New York City police are desperate. You say that at least 50% of shootings are gang-related?
Totally. Yeah, and that moves up and down. And we should define gang-related, too. That includes shootings in which the victim might have been a gang member or the suspect was a gang member. So you're right. I mean, look, that goes back to the narrative of the police there and that argument. I think that a lot of people would be able to argue rightfully that, look, there's half of the violent crime in this city is committed by gang members. And just a couple weeks ago, Commissioner O'Neill was saying, look, this tool is crucial for us.
All right, no easy answers. Thanks, Zolan. Wall Street Journal reporter Zolan Cano-Youngs joining us this morning. 20 minutes now in front of the hour. You're listening to This Morning, America's First News. It's one of the most significant threats to passenger safety, yet few are addressing the problem. Time after time, airline passengers fleeing a burning or a crippled airplane take their carry-on bags with them. Toting luggage slows escapes, could block exits, and risks puncturing emergency slides. And Wall Street Journal airline columnist Scott McCartney says, bluntly, this kind of behavior could get someone killed. Scott joins us now with more. Scott, what are we doing during these emergency landings that could be potentially fatal?
We're taking our carry-on bags, and it's a real problem. Stopping to take your carry-on bag slows you down, slows everybody behind you down. In some cases, the bags may be big enough to actually block the overwing exit doors. And a bigger danger people worry about is a bag actually ripping a evacuation slide. If the slide rips, it's not useful to anybody behind you.
You know, even if you're an infrequent flyer like me, you know, there's no greater bottleneck on an airplane than waiting for people to retrieve their luggage before deplaning. I mean, why would anybody think this is a good idea? Did you speak to anybody, or what do officials say about this?
Well, I think what happens is you have opportunity, and that's your training. That is the habit of what you do when you get off an airplane. So in an emergency evacuation, the bottleneck is still the doors. So you're going to spend some time waiting in the aisle before you can evacuate. So there you are waiting in the aisle. The overhead bin is right at your face. You reach up, grab the bag, and think nothing of it. But you don't realize that when you get to the door and you have to go down an evacuation slide, it's a very steep drop on a very bouncy slide, and you're going to want your arms free to steady yourself, and you can't do that if you're carrying a rollerboard bag.
So in some cases, it's not necessarily people being selfish. It's sort of involuntary, people reaching up to reach for their bags when they would anyway. But the problem is you're multiplying that times 100 or 200 people, and that's where the problem comes in.
Well, yeah. In an emergency, you know what pilots get taught. You revert to your training. You revert to the norm, right? It's interesting. The reason that flight attendants tell you how to unbuckle the seatbelt, which seems inane to so many people, is because it's different from unbuckling your car seatbelt. So a car, you push the button, right? And in an airplane, you pull the flap. And the problem is, when you're panicking, you lose sort of logic thought, and you just revert to habit. And so there have been accidents where people start trying to push the button to get out of the seat, and they can't get out of the seat. They forget that they have to lift the flap. And I think it's the same thing with carry-on bags. We carry so much stuff in there that's of value to us. I hear from people time after time. People say, well, that's my life in there. It's my computer, my phone, my whatever. The reality is somebody's going to get hurt someday from this. There's a lot more carry-on baggage getting stuffed into the cabin. And, safety investigators have shown in accident after accident that evacuations have been slowed by carry-on baggage. And the fear is that unless something is done to address the problem, somebody's going to get killed.
You give examples in your column of a WestJet flight in Toronto, an American flight in Chicago, where the evacuation was slowed by people retrieving their luggage when the plane was actually on fire. I mean, if you don't move quickly to exit a plane when it's on fire, when will you, right?
Yeah, that's right. People do go to extreme measures to get out of an airplane in a situation like that. There have been accidents where, some people, instead of waiting in the aisle, just climbed over seat row after row after row of seats to try and get to the exit more quickly.
Simply bizarre. Thanks, Scott. Wall Street Journal middle seat columnist Scott McCartney joining us from Dallas. 12 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Gordon's still off. I'm Mike Gavin. If you want to follow Gordon and his family on their Brady Bunch style Hawaiian vacation, you can do so on Twitter. Gordon is at Gordon Deal. Follow the show at This Morning Show, and you can find me at Radio Gavin 1. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, Jennifer Koshenka has returned with more of America's First News.
Mike, North Korean state media called on the U.S. today to drop sanctions, saying Pyongyang had demonstrated good faith by ending its nuclear weapons testing and handing over the remains of U.S. troops killed in the Korean War. The statement comes just days after a U.N. report concluded North Korea has not stopped its nuclear and missile programs and has continued to conduct illegal trades of oil, coal, and other commodities. At least 40 people were shot in Chicago over the weekend during the 7 hours from midnight Saturday to early yesterday morning, with 5 fatalities. Fred Waller of the Chicago Police Department says most of the shootings were connected to gang violence.
We all live in this city. We all want this city to be safer. The policemen who are out there protecting those streets, they live in that city. I have kids that go to public high school, so we all want a safer city.
Police are saying gunmen targeted a block party, a gathering after a funeral, and a downtown concert. New Mexico sheriff searching for a missing 3-year-old boy stumbled upon a heavily armed compound housing 11 starving children. The children, ages 1 to 15, were discovered in the compound, which was built out of garbage in the desert near Amalia. Sheriff Joseph Hogreff says in his 30 years on the job, he had never seen anything like this.
Horrible, deplorable, disgusting, filthy. These children are basically what you would see on television when you see photographs or pictures of children in third world countries.
Hogreff says high-powered weapons were also discovered at the site. The raid came after cops received a message believed to have originated inside the compound that stated, "We are starving and need food and water." Tom Cruise beat out Winnie the Pooh at the box office to lead all films for the second straight week with an estimated $35 million in ticket sales for Mission Impossible Fallout. The success of Paramount Pictures' sixth Mission Impossible installment, along with muted enthusiasm for Disney's Christopher Robin, made for a seldom-seen result, a Disney movie debuting in second place. Pooh took in a ho-hum $25 million.
Poor Pooh. He just can't catch a break, that Pooh. Now, I haven't seen this new Mission Impossible, and I haven't seen one. We were discussing this last week since, I think, 1996, since the first one came out, but I've heard that this one is probably the best one since that one.
I like this one a lot.
So I may have to check this one out. All right, thanks very much, Jen. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Well, we told you earlier this hour about how millennials are abandoning big brand beers in favor of hard liquor or wine, but those young folks might be wise to take some advice from Milwaukee resident Clotilda Court, who turned 100 years old on Saturday. To what does Clotilda credit her long life? Well, she has one daily habit that has kept her going for a century, drinking a Miller 64 beer. She told local TV that she downs one Miller 64 every day at 2 p.m., and that it's her favorite beer just because she likes the taste of it. And more good news for her on her milestone birthday, Miller Coors caught wind of her love of the beer and decided to help her celebrate by sending a package stuffed with branded t-shirts and hats and, of course, plenty of Miller 64 beer. The grandmother of 7 and great-grandmother of 9 says she doesn't feel any different turning 100, telling well-wishers at her party that she feels like she's 25. That's a wrap on this hour. For Gordon Deal and Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Mike Gavin. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.